Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today on Garden Talk, we'll be talking about what that late snow and cold means for this year's growing season. Diana Alfeth back with us from our studios in Eau Claire. Actually, it's great to have her along today. She's the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. So we can talk a little bit about phenology, how it relates to the growing season, also talk about starting seeds, how to make your soil in great shape, or how to make sure it is in great shape as well, and of course, answer your gardening questions. Call in 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can go ahead and post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Diana Alfeth, welcome.
Hi, Larry.
Good to hear your voice.
Well, it's great to be here again, despite this unbelievable weather we're having out there.
How much snow do you have in Pierce County right now?
We easily have 10 inches on the ground. We got at least 10 where I live with this last storm, and some of it melted because the sun angle is high and stuff. But we have, like here in Eau Claire, this morning it's 13 degrees and we have record lows and record low high temperatures, and it's just not fair.
You know what, it's going to screw up our gardening a little bit, I think. Perhaps.
You know, this is a reminder that we need to watch the weather and pay attention to the weather and not necessarily garden by the calendar, because, you know, there have been past years where we've had 80-degree temperatures by now, and this year we have only hit 50 degrees once. So we aren't planting anything anytime soon.
At least not in the ground.
Right, right. Houseplants, you know, pay attention to your houseplants and give them a little extra TLC right now.
You know, we talk about degree days, and I think this year it can be as much as any year play an important role. And maybe talk about that and how it's used in phenology.
Sure. So, you know, we have people I talk to say, oh, you always plant your peas on this date and you always plant your potatoes on this date and stuff. But obviously with 10 inches of snow on the ground and frozen ground, you might not be meeting those dates this year. So everything in nature, the insects and the plants out in nature, develops in response to how much warmth we get. And basically, for the most part, we use a base number of 50 degrees. So when it's below 50 degrees, most things out in nature are not developing at all because it's just too cold. So once we start getting days above 50 degrees, we accumulate heat units, or also called degree days. So for example, if we use a base of 50 degrees, if we get to 60 degrees that day for a high temperature, and then we take the average of the high and the low of 60 and 50, and that would be 55, then on that day we will have accumulated 5 degree days. And things develop, every time they get some degree days, they develop a little bit more. If we get a cold spell, they stop developing, and it all adds up. So once we get, like, I think it's 50 degree days, we'll start seeing some dandelions popping up or blooming. And we can use these degree days throughout the year to predict when things are going to bloom, when things are going to hatch. It's really good for gardeners to pay attention to some of these things, because you can watch for insect outbreaks and then protect your plants accordingly. So rather than, you know, trying to protect against an insect that isn't going to hatch out for 3 weeks yet, you can, all you need is a maximum thermometer, which are really cheap, you can get, and you can have it in your backyard, so you can monitor what the high and the low for the day was, and then figure out your degree days, and then watch for certain pests when they're going to be hatching, yeah, and being a problem.
So it's not just for starting when to put your seeds in.
No, it's not. And actually, it's because we don't know, for example, what next week is going to bring. So far, up here in northern Wisconsin, we have not accumulated any degree days this year, okay? Because we've only hit 50 degrees once. And you know, down in the southern part, you probably have accumulated some, and they may have stopped accumulating here for a few days. But that all is affecting things out in nature, so the plants and the insects out there. We don't know what next week's weather is going to bring, of course. So, yes, we have 10 inches of snow on the ground right now. We have a lot of frost in the ground yet. So we can't get out there and plant until first we melt off the snow, thaw out the ground, and then it has to dry out enough that we can work the soil. That can happen really quickly if we get a really hot spell. You know, if the end of next week we all of a sudden hit 80 degrees for a week, things will warm up and dry out fast. But we don't know. That is, of course, always the problem. If we could predict it, it would just be so routine and boring, right? But as far as planting our seeds go, we are assuming that by Memorial Day, we're going to be able to plant tomatoes and stuff outside. And that's one of the reasons, years like this, because we don't know what to expect, that's one of the reasons we usually recommend that we shoot for, at least in the northern part of the state, Memorial Day, and maybe more like May 15th in the southern part of the state, is that you shoot for that as your date for planting warm season crops outside. So tomatoes and peppers and melons and things. And in some years, yeah, you could put them out earlier, but in other years like this, you're going to need to wait until Memorial Day. And it really has to do with the soil temperature. So those warm season crops like tomatoes, it's not just the fact that we're not getting frost at night anymore. It's the soil temperature as well. And if you put those warm season crops out in soil that's below 60 degrees and nights that are maybe still getting down to the upper 40s, those plants don't develop once they're out there because they're not getting enough of these heat units that we're talking about. And the roots need to be warm enough to be able to take up moisture and nutrients out of the soil. So this year is just kind of a reminder for us to not be in a big hurry because nature just may not cooperate with our quest to have the first ripe tomato in the neighborhood.
And I really think it is a great year to be thinking about those degree days, for sure.
It is. And how it will affect us throughout the rest of the growing season is if we have certain insects that, like Colorado potato bug, for example, especially in southern Wisconsin, usually you can get two generations of that insect throughout a year. But if they get a really slow and late start, like they are going to this year, we may only end up with one generation of that insect. So in some ways, that helps us out. If we're getting this late start, we're going to keep our fingers crossed that we get a late warm fall so that we can have the long growing season that we need for some of our things to get a good yield and get good production. And again, that's something we just don't know what we'll get in fall. But the point is right now, we're going to get a later start and we can't be in a hurry. We've got to watch things to see how that soil temperature warms up and how it gets dry before we get out there in a hurry. And, we've just got to be patient.
Well, Dan in Milwaukee has something for us. So let's go there and find out what is on Dan's mind. Hi, Dan. Dan, are you with us? Well, let's see here. Maybe I pushed the wrong button. Dan, are you there?
Hi, Larry.
Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you for having me and your fantastic program, Garden Talk. I love listening to you.
Thank you.
And very fascinating conversation you and your guests are having about those heating units. I was not aware of that, and I'm learning new things all the time. my new wife and I were young Milwaukeeans. We have an indoor garden that we've had over the winter where we're growing just some microgreens and little things here and there. She's teaching me a lot. But we're having a lot of issues with fruit flies, like, all over our apartment. And I'm guessing from having listened to your program previously that it might have to do with our soil being too organic or too rich in organic compound. But we've tried some things like putting cups of like an apple cider vinegar with like a slice of strawberry out throughout our apartment. And we're able to catch some of them with it, but still it's just a real nuisance. And I was wondering if you and or your guests had any ideas of how we can get rid of these little critters.
Yeah.
Actually, I doubt they're fruit flies. I think what you've got are fungus gnats. And they are a different insect, even though they are about the same size and they look very similar. So they go for different things. And that's partly why you're not getting a big catch in your vinegar, because fruit flies do go for the vinegar, but fungus gnats don't necessarily. So what fungus gnats do is they lay their eggs in moist organic matter. So typically when people have these little insects flying around in the winter, my first question for them is always, do you have houseplants? And they say yes. And I say, how often do you water your houseplants? And they usually have some kind of a every Monday morning schedule or something like that. And what happens is the adults lay their eggs on the surface of the soil. So that's what they're doing probably in your microgreen growing and stuff. And then the eggs hatch and the larva feed on the organic matter in that potting mix. And then they hatch out and they are adults and they fly around. So the key is they need, those larvae need to have moist potting mix in order to survive. So the key, if it's just house plants, is always, I just tell people, don't water your house plants as much. Make sure that the top three quarter inch of the soil is dry before you water again, and that will clear up your fungus gnat problems.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what you have to be looking for, is that moist soil. Now with microgreens, you have you need it to be moist because you can't let those little things dry out as much. But you have to look for ways to eliminate moist potting mix surfaces where they can be laying their eggs, and then you will just eliminate their breeding, and then you'll eliminate them altogether.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense, because we just got over dealing with dampening in our plant where we
damping
were having
off.
Fungus growing. Yeah, okay. Damping off, I'm sorry, yes. And we put a fan in the room. We used cinnamon, and that helped a little bit, sprinkling ground cinnamon over the top of the soil. But, okay, it sounds like that's very fascinating. I really appreciate that. They're not even fruit flies, probably.
No.
That would make sense.
And let the plants tell you when it's time to water. You know, if you've got house plants, if they start to wilt a little bit, all right, that's about, it's time to water them.
Yeah, that's actually probably a little late for their health, but your finger is your best guide. If you stick your finger in that soil, and if it's damp on the surface or just below the surface, don't water, because there's enough moisture in that root zone yet. But once you get down 3/4 of an inch and it's dry, that's the time to water. And that's also, again, it's just a cultural way to control those fungus gnats.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. I appreciate it very much, both of you. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Right,
thanks so much. And Bob in Brule up next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks. I got a question about frost seeding.
Okay.
Now, I'm up here between Lake Nebagamon and Brule in Douglas County, and there's, I don't know, between 12 and 18 inches of snow out there yet. But I guess I have two questions. I've got 2 acres of clover. I want to plant white Durana clover. And can you plant the seed right over the snow, or you got to wait till it's gone? And is clover effectively planted and with the frost seeding method?
So what's under the snow right now? Is it bare soil?
Bare soil that grew clover very nicely last year.
Okay. So why would it not grow clover this year? I mean, is it a perennial clover that was there?
No, it was an annual clover that I used just as a cover crop.
I
want to put a perennial long-growing clover in.
Okay. So, yeah, you can do frost seeding with clover. And basically what I would probably suggest is that you wait until that snow level melts down a little bit, because 12 to 16 inches, we don't know that's a long way to the soil surface yet, and a lot of things can happen in between there. But once you get down to where you've got just a couple inches of snow left, you can scatter seed, whether it's grass seed or clover will work as well, on top of that snow. And then as that snow continues to melt, it just kind of sucks that seed down right to the soil surface, and you get a really good seed-to-soil contact. And it won't germinate until that soil temperature gets warm enough for that seed to do, it's the same thing of talking about these degree days here. It has to have enough development within that seed, and there's a bunch of chemical processes that go on inside that seed to cause it to germinate. But frost seeding can be very effective because it, like I said, it gets good seed-to-soil contact. You've got that moisture there, and you can get that seed out there earlier than you could if you had to wait until the soil dried off enough for you to be walking on it and spreading seed out there. The only disadvantage, really, with frost seeding is the longer that seed's out there and not germinated, the more susceptible it is to become bird food or mouse food, or fungus can get at it or things like that. So you might lose some of that seed by getting it out there earlier, but frost seeding can be very effective, and yes, it works with clover.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Bob. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking today with Diana Alfeth, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller. Jane Rotunda, our guest. She's my guest today here in the studio right next to me. She's also the producer, and she has a friendly voice when you call in at 800-642-1234, and I hope you do that, and she probably does too. She'd love to talk to you here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden and the potential probable late start that you're going to get with your garden this year with our guest Diana Alfeth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on Garden Talk. You can join in 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page as well. A caller in Eau Claire wanted to know how the late freeze will affect the fruit tree blossoms, particularly apples, peaches, and plums. What do you think, Diana?
Well, at this point, I really don't think there's going to be an effect because they have not started opening yet. Usually when we have a problem is when those flowers have started to open and then they get frozen and the pollen and stuff gets killed off, and then we don't get pollination, so we don't get fruit. But nothing has started breaking bud yet up here because we haven't had any warmth. And again, that goes back to we haven't had any degree days, and we need those degree days to accumulate up to a point to where those buds open up. So I don't think it's going to have any effect on it yet. We'll see what the future weather brings.
All right. Let's go back to the phones, this time to Seth in Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Hi, Seth.
Hey, Larry. How's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I started tomatoes indoors, all heirloom varieties, end of February, beginning of March, and they got really big really fast, and they're starting to just look kind of weird and like curl up and do some weird things. And as you know, the spring conditions aren't really cooperating with getting tomatoes outdoors, so I'm just kind of wondering what I should do to keep them going good until I can get them outdoors.
How many do you have? A lot of plants, by the way.
Yeah, like 20 probably.
20, okay. What do you think, Diana?
Where do you live?
Brooklyn, Wisconsin.
Southern, just 10 miles south of Madison.
Okay. So this kind of all goes back to where, you know, we usually use like May 15th in the southern part of the state and Memorial Day up here as our target to plant things outdoors. And then with tomatoes, you go 8 weeks before that when you start them indoors. So in northern Wisconsin, we say, you know, really, we shouldn't be starting them until like April 1st. So you got a really, really early start on yours, which...
I think I got a little antsy, but I'm trying to figure out how to salvage it.
That's understandable. You know, we all do that. So the biggest thing that is a detriment to growing our seedlings inside is not enough light and too warm of temperatures. So you have a supplemental light system, or are you just growing them on a windowsill?
Yeah, I use one of those T11 or T1s or whatever they are, like the standard grow light. It's got four long bulbs on it.
Okay, that's good. And what's the temperature in the room that you have them in?
The temperature is pretty warm. We have a gas fireplace that is on quite often, and we have baby chicks that we're trying to keep warm. So this is definitely making me think.
Yeah, so that's the problem. What we really want is bright light and cool temperature. So ideally, they're going to have bright light 16 to 18 hours a day. So you put those lights on a timer. You want those lights to be just about 4 inches above the foliage so that you're getting the full power of those lights. And ideally, the growing conditions would be like 66 to 68 degrees. So what happens?
I think we're closer to like 70, and we still have the little soil heater mats underneath them as well.
Okay, yeah. So the soil heater mats warm the roots, and that can promote good root growth, and that's a good thing. But so from your question about, okay, how do I salvage this? If you can somehow move that setup into cooler conditions, and the thing
spare
is that, you know,
room or something.
Yeah, and that doesn't have the heat on, because on a day like today, even it's going to be only like in Eau Claire here, we're only predicted to be in the 20s, but that sun is so strong. So when it comes in the windows, it can easily warm your living room up to 75, 76 degrees if you have a lot of windows. And that warm temperature causes those cells to divide fast. And that's why you get this kind of funky growth and curling growth and weak growth. Because these cells are growing fast, but it's a combination of light and temperature. So bright light, cooler temperatures makes them stockier.
I have a greenhouse, but it's still like it's just too cold. I don't want to risk it because, I mean, they'll die even if they get a little. Like, I mean, 40 degrees, I figure, would kill a tomato plant, right? I don't even want to risk them getting that cool.
Yeah, well, 40 degrees won't kill a tomato plant, but it's going to stop developing at that point. So so it's just like in fall, you know, they don't die unless they get actual frost on them.
Right.
So they're not going to grow at 40 degrees, and 40 degrees is a little cool. You can get a little chill injury, and you can get issues. So that, you're right, that is a little cool. What you want is somewhere in between.
Okay, that's great.
Are they getting pretty leggy?
They're not getting leggy. I did transplant them when they started getting weird, and that seemed to stop them from getting weird for a while, but that was about 2 weeks ago, and now they're doing it again. They're nice, stocky plants. They're not real leggy, but it's just that curling and just kind of looking sickly.
Yeah.
Well, and with those symptoms, take a really good look, too, and make sure you don't have something like spider mites or aphids sucking some of the juices out of the leaves, because that can make leaves curl. And then you said there's a gas fireplace in the area, but you don't.
Yep.
It's okay. Curling, you know, we start to worry about a little bit. You know, if it's outside, we would be looking at like herbicide drift or chill injury or something like that. So curling is a little weird of a symptom, but if you want to, you know, take a couple pictures of them and email them to me, we can take a look too and try to see if there's anything else that might be going on there.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know what, Diana, let's just go right back to the phones here. Lee and Ripon, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Good morning. My question is also about starting things indoors. I'm wondering if, for annual flowers, if there's any kind of consensus, whether it's better to start flowers from seeds, or is it just easier and probably just as cost-effective to go to a retailer and buy them later on in the season when they're already started?
Oh, that's an easy question. It depends.
Yeah.
So it depends on which kinds of annuals you're looking to grow. Some of them are really easy to grow from seed, like marigolds. And some of them are harder, like impatiens take quite a long time. You need a lot of weeks. And geraniums, you need a lot of weeks. It's like 16 to 18 weeks ahead of time that you need to plant them. So it depends on what annuals you're growing.
Well, and then let me mention petunias.
Yeah, and petunias are somewhere in between. I think they take like 14 weeks, and I have grown them from seed. The key is similar to what we were just talking about with the last caller, is you have to have a setup for it. So it's hard to grow good annual flower transplants other than the fast-growing ones like marigolds or zinnias on just a windowsill. So you need an extra light setup, and you need a area that it's not going to be too warm. So if you had like an unheated basement that the temperature is 65 to 66, 67 degrees, and you put up a fluorescent light system, you can grow really, really nice annual flower transplants in something like that. But if you're just trying to grow them on the windowsill of your living room where the day sun gets that room up to 75 degrees and you don't have supplemental light, then you're not going to have a lot of good success. So it kind of depends on what you're growing, what kind of setup you have, and how many of them you want to get. Because sometimes it is going to be just a whole lot easier to go down to the local greenhouses and buy your transplants and, you know, get the different varieties and do it that way.
Yeah. I was talking about that with Melinda Myers here a couple weeks back, and we both agreed that you just can't wait to see the flowers going, so you run to the garden center and get some that are already blooming and put them in, at least a few.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, it's fun to do. It's fun to trial them. And you can, the advantage to growing your own is you can go through the catalogs and you can get seeds for varieties that you're not going to find in your local greenhouse. Because your local greenhouse only has so much space, so they only have so many different varieties available. So if you want something unique and different and special, you can grow them from seed. But now that we're into April, we're starting to get kind of late for starting some of these annuals, other than something fast-growing like marigolds or zinnias.
Thanks again, Lee. Lauren in Burlington, your turn now. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. I'm so happy to hear your voice. Anyway, I'm calling because our bulb started, sprouting a couple of weeks ago. We have about 3 inches of growth, I believe, on the crocuses and the hyacinths were coming up. Are those shot now with the really cold weather we've had?
Oh.
Or do you think that they'll come back?
They'll be fine. It kind of depends on how far along they were. If they were already blooming and those petals now will freeze and stuff, you may not have any more flowers this year. If there's just some leaves that were coming up, pretty much they'll just stop growing and they'll be under that snow and they'll wait until it warms up again and they'll start growing up again and then they'll send up that flower stalk because that flower stalk is probably still underground. But it kind of depends on where you are. I know people who had crocuses blooming last week before the snow hit, and the bulb itself is not going to die off. This happens all the time for them. So, and there's nothing you can do about it anyway.
I know, but I so look forward to those. That to me, and I was so stoked because they were up at school and they were up at home, and yes, I'm finally going to get to see some flowers. And then, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Yeah, thanks, Lauren. Well, you could come down to my house. I have some Creeping Charlie in bloom right next to the house.
Do you? Really? Wow.
Right next to the house where it's warmer.
Huh. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Let's go to Margot in Winneconne next. Hi, Margot.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I am a new second floor condo resident, and this is my third year. And previously I lived out in the country and had a pretty decent garden. And I am just longing to have more garden. And I have a three seasons porch that faces south with two large entries to the three seasons porch. And I would love to just kind of create a mini greenhouse out there. However, the temperatures do fluctuate extremely. Even in this time of the year, my two cats love going out there in the afternoon because the temperatures get up pretty high. But I'm wondering if you think that's a possibility. I do have grow lights, and I had house plants out there until January 4th with grow lights, and then one night forgot to turn the little heater on, and so I had a couple of frozen house plants. I'm wondering if there are any sites or any books that I might be able to learn from. And I was listening to the other caller and about fungus gnats and fruit flies. I certainly do not want those because this is my, I mean, I sometimes open those doors just to bring the heat into my, condo too. So what do you think?
Well, I think you can definitely have a little greenhouse out there.
Sure.
And you already, it sounds like you already have when you had the houseplants out there.
Sounds like
you've got lights, you've got a little heater for when it gets a little bit too cold. So you absolutely can do that. And yeah, you have to have to keep an eye on things, but even if you have a true greenhouse, you have to keep an eye on things. So true greenhouses have nowadays mostly computer sensors, and if it gets too warm, they'll automatically open vents or turn fans on things like that. So there are lots of, if you just like hit the internet and look at greenhouse supplies and you'll see all kinds of little gadgets and stuff like that. So as long as you've got the light, you can, like I told the last caller, you can grow stuff in the basement if you've got grow lights.
You got a south-facing situation there, which is perfect.
Light.
As long as you don't have a great big tree growing right outside of that.
No trees. I kind of miss the trees. There's no trees.
Oh, okay.
I would actually be more concerned with it getting too warm in there because the little heater, especially now, I shouldn't say that because we were down to, 9 degrees last night, so that's like January weather. For the most part, by the time we get into March and April, the nights don't get as cold. And if you have that little heater as a backup, that'll get you through the nights. I'm more concerned about it getting too warm in there in the daytime.
That's what I'm worried about, too.
So is there any way that you can, if you're around and you know that by 10 o'clock it's going to start getting warm, if you can just go open a window or a door or something and let it vent out some, or even opening that into your condo so that some of that heat goes in there and somehow monitor.
A couple of fans
would be fabulous. Help. Yep, fans would be great. And you can also get, again, if you look for greenhouse supply companies and stuff, you can get little alarms, so it'll like set off an alarm if the temperature gets above, 75 degrees or something. So that'll tell you, I better go and open something or turn the fan on or somehow cool it down.
Yeah.
So it's a way to monitor it. And then, the fungus gnat thing, again, is very manageable as long as you don't overwater and you let the surface of the soils dry out before you water again. And then you really don't have a big fungus gnat problem. But once you get those fungus gnats, it'll take a couple weeks of letting things dry out before they all go away because, you're getting hatchings and stuff. But if you don't overwater, you shouldn't have a fungus gnat issue, and you definitely could grow a lot in a situation like that.
Go for it, Margot. Go for it. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Patricia in Powers, Michigan. Your turn now. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. How are you all?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I have a Siberian iris plant that in the fall makes pods that are full of seeds, and I tried to keep the pod over the winter, and then I went online to read about how you actually plant the seeds, and it said to soak them in water for a few days and then put them in soil. And so I tried doing that, and at the same time, I also planted cucumber seeds. And the cucumbers are about 4 inches tall now, and there's still no sign of anything from the Siberian irises. And I'm wondering if I did something wrong or if I should keep hoping.
How deep did you plant those seeds?
Not very deep, because I figured that they probably follow the pahad and then hit bare ground and sort of work their way down maybe a quarter of an inch or so.
Yeah, okay.
So it was shallow.
So what do you think, Diana?
Well, I wouldn't give up on them yet. Cucumbers actually germinate very quickly.
Yeah.
Those seeds just, they can germinate within days. So they have a thinner seed coat so they can soak up the water faster and then they can get going faster. Siberian iris, I'm not exactly sure of what the time is for a seed to germinate, but as an example, Kentucky bluegrass can take 3 weeks to germinate, whereas a fescue seed can take 4 days. So it might just be that the Siberian iris take longer to germinate. And by soaking them in the water for that first 48 hours, that's an attempt to soften up that seed coat and let water get into the seed so the germination process can start. So I would, you know, kind of nose around in there a little bit and look at the seed. And as long as it doesn't look moldy or mushy, I would just cover it back up and wait a little bit longer. It might also help if you you have those in a warm place. So with seed germination, we want it warm. Once the plant starts growing, then we want to move it into a cool area. But if you had like a way to warm that soil, like the seed starting mat, or even if you have in-floor heat, if you set it on the ground, that helps to keep the soil warmer. That will help speed germination. I just wouldn't give up on them yet. And I wouldn't compare them to cucumbers.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you for the advice.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to Lou and Cudahy next. Hi, Lou.
Good morning. I acquired some seeds in Door County of hollyhocks of various colors, and one I'm especially intrigued with is a peach-colored hollyhock. I'm going to start those seeds now. And in the past, I've had problems with damp-off fungus or whatever that is. I need a way to combat that, and also how to start fragrant sweet peas. They have a hard shell. I've tried to soak those to soften them, and sometimes they break open and other times not, and I just can't get those things going.
Okay, well, damping off is a little fungus that basically goes across the surface of your potting mix, and it hits the tiny little seedlings, and it kills them. It looks like they were strangled at soil level, and they just tip right over. And
right.
it can happen very quickly. So the keys to avoiding damping off are, first, use a sterile seed starting mix. So don't use garden soil. Don't use old potting soil or anything. Go to the store, spend the few dollars on a bag of seed starting mix. And it's usually just a finely milled peat moss, and it's sterile.
Right.
Okay, so you're not starting with the fungal diseases there. Then when you plant your seeds, you have to keep them moist until they germinate. But once they germinate, it's the same thing we've been talking about here. Let the surface dry out before you water again. So if the surface is still damp, don't water. Let that surface dry out a little bit. Keep your plants well aerated. So a lot of people will have a little oscillating fan blowing so that it's just enough to keep air circulation on that soil surface. And that discourages that fungus from taking hold. And the side effect is by rattling those little stems a little bit, it actually makes them stronger. So this is how, Larry, this is how you singing to your plants is a valuable thing, because you go in there and you look at your little seedlings and you sing to them and you breathe on them and you're blowing a little carbon dioxide on them and rattling them, moving them a little bit, and that makes them stronger. But that will help with keeping that damping off fungus from getting there. Now, if you're really, really concerned, you know, there are fungicides, but that shouldn't be necessary. As long as you're starting with a sterile seed starting mix and you're not overwatering, you really shouldn't have a damping off problem.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Oh, and then he had the question about the sweet peas.
Yes.
Usually it is soaking them and breaking that seed coat should get them going. So, but you know, I've never had great luck with sweet peas either. I get very, very low germination rate, and I don't know if they're just prone to that, but soaking them does help you to get them started. And even if it hasn't cracked all the way open, as long as that seed has swollen, that's gotten water into the seed, and that's what starts the chemical processes that start the germination process.
There you go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. Back to our earlier caller who was calling, who lives in a condo. You know, we do have an extension publication that she might just want to go online to. It's called Container Gardening, and it's for both vegetables and flowers and for folks who live in apartments or condos. Diana, what do you think?
Absolutely. That is a wonderful publication. It gives you just kind of the concepts of growing things in containers. You can grow anything in containers, and including potatoes, for goodness sake.
Yep.
So there's no excuse not to grow some vegetables no matter where you are. As long as you've got at least 6 hours of sun a day, you can grow any kind of vegetable in a container. You can grow them in a bucket hanging from a hook. You can... You can grow them in a hanging basket just like you would petunias or anything else. So the Container Gardening publication is very helpful, and it's just a matter of having a deep enough root system in there. And then you have to, you know, water them every day because containers dry out and you maybe are managing them a little more intensely, but you can get a lot of yield in a small space with containers.
There you go. Diana Alfuth, our guest today, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden today here on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with Diana Alfuth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Great to have her along. Thanks for listening in. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Hans in Sturgeon Bay says, I typically rotate my garden crops but have left the perennial rhubarb, elderberry bush, and an asparagus patch. I've yet to harvest any asparagus because it was first planted a couple of years ago. I want to harvest this summer, though, as the stalks look good last year. Should I consider rotating the asparagus in the future? If so, how frequently? I guess I've never thought about rotating the asparagus.
Nope, you don't need to rotate the asparagus as long as it's growing well. The only time that we, with these perennial crops, they're meant to stay there and produce year after year after year. So there's no reason to dig them up or move them or anything like that unless you have some kind of major problem get in there. So once in a while, you might get some kind of a soil-borne fungus or root rot or something in a patch of perennial something or another, and it's not doing well, and then we'll just recommend that you start a new patch in a new place. But no reason to do that with the asparagus. I know people who have had asparagus patches that are 30 years old and more. So it's as long as you keep the weeds out of it so that it doesn't get overgrown by weeds, and you fertilize it every year, you'll have asparagus for many, many years to come.
Sure will. Jackson in Sheboygan emailed, I'll be moving across the state to River Falls in a few weeks. And
ooh,
looking,
our neighborhood.
Yeah, looking to find a place to garden. Are there websites or organizations to contact? I'd like to rent a small garden plot.
There are some community gardens around. River Falls is my county. So there's a Grow to Share community garden by Hoffman Park in River Falls. And we've got a few other community gardens around the area. So when you get here and you're ready to go, just call me at the Pierce County Extension office and I'll give you the contact info.
There we go. Somebody, we were talking earlier about gnats. Gary in Iron River said coarse mason sand can help with gnats. Has that been your experience?
So I'm assuming that he means that you're putting a layer of sand on top of the soil surface. And yes, that actually is going to, because that's going to dry out and it's going to make it a not a good place for those gnats to lay their eggs and for the larva to hatch and live. So that would help. It's a matter of breaking that reproductive cycle and not having that surface be moist.
Mark in Waukesha, it is your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. My question is regarding the fact that my wife and I are going to be trying to do a raised bed vegetable garden for the first time this year. We're starting to work on that. And I heard on your show a few weeks ago, I think it was, your guest and you were saying that the best mixture for a raised bed garden is one part compost, vermiculite, and peat moss. And so I'm looking into that, and peat moss and vermiculite are really expensive for quality stuff. And I have a good deal on compost, though. So I'm wondering if I skimp on the peat moss and the vermiculite a little bit, not too much, still put a significant amount, but not quite equal parts, is that going to have a big effect? And if are there any other things that I might put in there to supplement it if I don't want to spend all that on the peat moss and vermiculite?
Sure. Thanks for calling, Mark. Diana, what do you suggest?
Okay, so this is a new raised bed, so we're talking maybe 6x4 or something like that, or maybe even bigger and built up about a foot tall?
Yeah, 10x4 and then 10 inches tall is what we're planning.
Okay, so you mentioned peat moss and vermiculite, but you didn't mention garden soil or anything?
Well, we're going to do compost. There's an organic compost source we have. And so that's kind of we can get more for our buck on the compost. It's the other stuff that seems to be expensive as far as I've been shopping around for.
Well, typically in a raised bed, you're going to want some actual soil too. So compost is all organic matter. There's no sand, silt, or clay in there at all. And same with vermiculite and peat moss. So if you just did compost, vermiculite, and peat moss, you're basically having an all organic soil. And not that that's not doable, because that's basically what we use for containers and hanging baskets and things like that. But typically in a raised bed that you're going to be growing vegetables in it, you would also want some topsoil in there, because that's going to hold nutrients better. It's going to fill things. So my suggestion would be that you get some topsoil that actually is sand, silt, or clay, and you know, find that locally to fill that in, and then put a bunch of that compost in there. That compost is going to give you a lot of nutrients. The organic matter is great for the microbes, and it's going to give you water-holding capacity, that sort of a thing. Some vermiculite helps to hold moisture as well as aerate soil. So vermiculite's good, but we don't usually put it in an outdoor garden like this that much, because, like you say, you kind of need a lot of it to really have an effect. But we do put it into container planting mixes a lot of times. So I think if you can find a source with some topsoil and then put in a bunch of that compost, you'll be great for having a raised bed vegetable garden.
I think that, I was trying to remember that earlier conversation. It may have been some issue. The person was worried about weeds and such.
Okay.
And so I think that was why that suggestion came out.
The thing is, if you have a raised bed and you put just compost and peat and in there, it's going to, that's all organic matter, and that's going to decompose every year. So every year you're going to have to add something more to it.
Right.
Because it's going to sink as it decomposes. So that's part of having some mineral soil in there, as well as, like I said, the sand, silt, and clay, that holds on to nutrients and provide some of the trace minerals as well, and it's going to be more stable. Typically we would use a lot of topsoil in a raised bed and then amend it a lot with a good amount of that compost. And peat is basically just another form of organic matter. So you can, if you put in a lot of the compost in with the topsoil, you don't necessarily need peat unless you were trying to lower the pH or something, because peat is a real low pH. You got your soil mix in there and stuff, do a soil test, see what your pH is at, and then you could go from there.
Yeah. Good luck, Mark. Thank you very much for calling. And Nick and Anigo, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hi. I was just calling. I ordered about 140 bare root apple trees this year. They came out of Tennessee.
and I got too warm down there early, so he had to ship them up here. I've had them in my garage since about mid-March. I just got them with wet sawdust on top of the roof. But is there anything else I should worry about? I was hoping that I'd be able to get rid of them by now. But
yeah, understood.
Yeah. As long as they're dormant, you can keep them dormant for a length of time. The key is to keep them cool, so like a refrigerator temperature cool. You don't want them to be getting above, I wouldn't even let them get above 45 degrees, because if they start getting above 45 degrees, they're going to start thinking about breaking dormancy and leafing out. And as long as they're bare root, you want to keep them dormant up until you get them outside, and then they can do their thing. And then the other thing is just making sure that those roots stay moist. You don't want them to dry out. So if you've got them around, if you've got moist sawdust around them, that should be just fine. But the other key is just, you know, watch it if it starts getting warm in your garage. One other concern we have about in garages are exhaust fumes. And exhaust fumes can give off ethylene gas. It shouldn't affect them too much, because you're not worrying about flower buds. So that's why we don't want to store like bulbs and stuff in a garage. So it really shouldn't affect them, but just watch that temperature mostly.
Yeah, keep a really close eye on the temperature. Well, our guest today is Diana Alfith. Diana is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She also teaches courses in landscape design at the University of Wisconsin River Falls. And boy, it's always fun to have her with us. And to talk about gardening here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, happy to have you with us today as we visit with Diana Alfith, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She's talking to us from our WPR studios in Eau Claire. Always great to have that opportunity to visit with folks from around the state and one of our many studios around the state. You have some questions about gardening. I hope you'll join in. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And Diana, we had an email from Ray. Actually, it was a Facebook question from Ray. About Limey, my lime tree.
I was going to ask you how Limey's doing.
Limey's doing great. Limey is really, I don't know how many limes. I didn't count. We lost, Limey aborted some because she had about 40.
Oh, my gosh.
So now I think we're down around 25 or so.
Is she pounding on the window wanting to get outside and wanting it to warm up?
She wants to get outside for sure. She can't wait to get outside, I'm pretty sure of that. Join the other plants that are will join her outside. But she's a Bears lime tree. Ray wondered what kind. And Bears is spelled with two S's, so B-E-A-R-S-S. So that's, and it's a pretty, you know, the pot, I don't know, two and a half feet tall, and Limey's probably about a couple feet tall, two, maybe 3 feet tall. She produces a lot of limes every year.
Yeah, you seem to have a very productive tree there with a lot of longevity. How long have you had her now?
Several years now. I think she may be, I don't know. I thought she was going to be a goner this last year. I repotted her again, and she took right off again. So
let me ask you this, Larry. Do you have, is Limey stake? Do you have a stake in the container to help support her?
I should have a stake in the container to support her, but no, I don't. She's on her own, and she has tilted a lot. So when I take her back outside, I'm going to face her the other direction from the sun and hope she works her way back the other way.
I acquired a young type of an orange tree, again, an indoor citrus tree, just last year, and put on a ton of growth. But I'm thinking that any more growth, and it's going to need a stake and some support. And maybe someday we can share citrus stories.
Yeah,
get any little oranges.
I should post some photos. I haven't posted one. I've got a photo from like last year when she had a whole bunch of limes on her. But I don't have a recent one, I guess. I've got a grow light. Actually, and I don't know if this is doing any good at all, but I have a couple of the new modern grow lights that are low energy. And I've got a couple of, I've got like a pole lamp kind of situation almost next to her. And so those lights are pretty close, and they're only covering, you know, two branches. But I figure a little is better than none at all. What do you think? Am I wasting my money?
Well, you know what's interesting is, and that's one thing that we should mention, light and the number of lumens that the plant is getting is what's important. And you know, getting some branches rather than all of them is better than nothing, right? But
Yeah. You
can get apps on your phone. You can download them for free that where you can measure how much light is actually hitting the leaves. So I have one on my phone. It's, I think, Galactica. And it... you can use it like for photography, you know, to tell how much light there is on a subject. But you can also just place it right by the leaves of your plant, and it'll tell you how many lumens of light are hitting those leaves. And that is a very, very eye-opening thing. Because even though our eyes, it looks like bright light to us, it's not as bright to the plant as we think it is. So if you were to take this plant meter and put it on the windowsill with the sun coming in your window, right in that bright sun, it'll have a high reading. But if you put it on the outside of your window, it'll be a way, 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 way higher reading. It's amazing how much light is lost going through glass.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, a lot of time putting things on the windowsill, it's not enough light. And you need these supplemental lights. But with all the different lights that are out there, like you mentioned, there's new LEDs, there's fluorescent, there's just even the old incandescents, they give off different amounts of light. And without a meter, our eyes really can't tell how much that is. And then the other difference is, the other part of it is how close to the leaves those lights are. So the closer, the better. And if you're trying to grow seedlings, we want those lights to be within 4 inches of that foliage to really be getting all the power out of those lights. So there's a lot of variability there. But you know, almost everybody has a smartphone, and you can download a light meter and kind of walk around your house and measure how much light is hitting your plants.
I'm going to do that. Galactica, huh?
There are a lot of them out there. That's just the one that I happen to have put on my phone, and it seems to be
working pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, limey is doing great, and again, limey is a bear's lime. There are certainly other ones out there. It just happens to be that's where that's the lime tree that I got, B-E-A-R-S-S.
Cool.
Let's take some calls. Bob in Pierce County. Hi.
Yeah, hi, this is Bob from River Falls, and actually I just bought a place near Beldenville, and I have kind of a blank slate as far as fruit trees and plants go. What would be a good thing to start the first few years? What would be a priority to start?
So you're looking at a big variety? Are you looking at a big orchard? Is this just for use?
What would be the most productive? Apples or berries or strawberries? Or, you know, I'm going to plant some every year, but what would be the first things that you would start?
Well, we always say to plant trees first because they take a while, a little bit longer before they're going to be producing things. So depending on how big of a tree you get, and dwarf trees will produce sooner than a semi-dwarf or a taller tree. But apples are great. We have lots of success with apples. Tart cherries are wonderful. If you like plums, plums are great. We can do pears. So those are the trees, and I always recommend you get some of those in the ground because it'll be at least a couple of years before you start getting any fruit off of those.
Do you want to have more than one of a species?
You do. Uh-oh. Thank you.
Go ahead.
So with apples, having more than one cultivar for pollination, if you have crab apple trees around, they'll do the pollination as well. Cherries are going to be better if they have a pollinator around. You can still get cherries even if you just have one tree for the tart cherries anyway. But they're going to be better, and the same with pears. There are different varieties available. It's kind of a case where you read the descriptions and get what you want. So in other words, when you're picking your apples, do you want to bake with them, or do you want to make applesauce, or do you want to just eat them fresh? And different apples have different attributes on which ones are better for which purpose. So plant a variety of those. And then as far as the smaller fruits go, we can easily grow grapes and raspberries and strawberries and blueberries. And so, what you're going to use is what's important. Raspberries, we have the challenge now of spotted wing Drosophila, which is a little fruit fly that really is hard to manage. And so a lot of people who have had raspberry patches have mowed them off and killed them off because they don't want to deal with it anymore. But strawberries and blueberries are still doing great. Grapes, we have tons and tons of vineyards going in.
Wouldn't hurt, though, to, I think since it's a blank slate and it's brand new, wouldn't hurt to get a soil test out of that, wouldn't it?
Oh, soil test. We haven't really talked about soil stuff here yet today. And absolutely. And once you decide which crops you're going to grow and where, that's when you start doing separate soil tests. So, for example, if you want to grow blueberries, you need to drop that pH way low, down around 4.5. And around Beldenville, the pH is going to be starting up in the upper 6s probably. So you're going to need to put a lot of sulfur on to bring it down to blueberries. You can certainly do it. It's not that it's not doable, but only a soil test is going to tell you how much you need to do to get that soil down where the blueberries will be happy. So soil tests, once the snow melts, and we keep saying that, once the snow melts, it is going to melt, right, Larry?
Yeah, I hope.
Once it melts and it dries out a little bit so that's not mud, it's the perfect time to take soil tests. And we recommend that you do a professional soil test, send it into a lab. You can get kits in the stores and stuff, but while they might give you some information, they don't give you the recommendations that you need, like you get from the soil labs. And you take about a cup of soil. You can contact your local Extension aid office, and we can get you the bags and the submission form and everything. It's $15. We recommend that you do it once every 5 years, so it's a minimal investment to be sure what you're doing. You just don't know how to amend your soil unless you know where you're starting.
Yeah, and when you send the sample in, you say, okay, I want to plant apple trees here or whatever.
Right, and they will tell you exactly how much of what to put on that soil to make it perfect for growing whatever crop it is that you're growing, whether it's a lawn or your perennial flowers or your vegetables or fruits or whatever. And then because you do have a blank slate, that soil test will also tell you how much organic matter is in your soil. So if you do decide to plant like a strawberry patch, you can work in a lot of compost or organic matter to get that soil nice and rich and well-drained and productive, because these are perennial plants. Our fruits are perennial plants, so we need to adjust that soil and amend that soil before we plant to get those things off to a good start.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks for calling. You mentioned blueberries, and I was blanking. There's another berry that's becoming popular that's kind of like blueberry, and I can't think of the name of it.
Are you thinking honeyberries?
Honeyberries, yeah.
Yeah.
They don't require as much acid in the soil, do they?
I don't think they do. People are starting to plant them because they've become available. I haven't heard anybody who's had them in for long enough to see how successful they are.
Oh.
I think people are a little surprised that the size of the berry, because they're small berries.
Yep.
So you have to do a lot of picking to get a bowl full. But it's always good to have, a variety and different things. So like we were just mentioning, the raspberries have become a challenge now because of this new pest. And so having a variety of things just in case something else comes through and bothers one of them, it is always a good idea in trying things, different things. We have service berries that we typically grow as ornamental plants, but those berries are really good to and edible and, and make great jams and jellies. And even aronia is another one that's hitting the news a lot. It's a we've grown it as a ornamental glossy black choke cherry, it's called. And it gets white flowers and these blue-black berries on it. And they're not really tasty to eat fresh, but you know, you add enough sugar to anything and it's good, right? But they're good for jams and jellies and juices because they're really high in antioxidants and really nutritious. So that's starting to hit the markets, and you can easily grow those in your backyard. They're very hardy plants.
Leo in Madison, let's give you a chance now. Thanks for calling, Leo.
Hi, yeah, about 4 years ago, I inherited a miniature orange tree. I have pictures of this orange tree from the 70s, and it's still the same size. It has not been repotted ever. I believe it's probably close to 60, 70 years old, and I've been trying to propagate it. I have tried clipping new growth, putting in a Rooney hormone, putting bottom heat on it. I have tried taking plugs, putting rooting hormone on a fresh stem on the live plant, putting water on it, trying to get roots. I can't get roots. I've tried taking the seeds and drying the seeds in the orange, thinking maybe that's what it needs. Maybe it needs to be out of the seed, out of the orange to dry. Maybe it needs to go through a feral pig and spend a week in a pile of dung before it'll grow. I don't know. Can you help me try to figure out how to propagate this plant before it dies? I'm afraid to repot it, too. It hasn't been repotted probably since the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. Does it get oranges?
Oh, it gets wonderful oranges. They're bitter. You know, so I looked it up, and I thought maybe it was from the Philippines. You know, there's a species that comes from there, but they're bitter. You put enough sugar in them, and they're good, like you said. And the flowers are really, they smell wonderful, like vanilla and orange and citrus, and just, it's a beautiful plant. It just, I'm afraid it's going to die someday, and I want to repot it. And it's been in the same pot now probably for 40 years, so...
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, citrus isn't real common up here in Wisconsin. So, quite honestly, I don't have much experience with with propagating an orange tree. So, first, you know, if it's happy and it's producing, normally we say, well, just leave it alone, right?
But that's what we've done for 40 years. We've left it alone and just given it water. I don't think it's been fertilized. I don't think we even fertilized. I put it outside on the deck in the summer, and it just explodes. Tons of oranges, and gets big, and you know, the blue jays come and pick off the oranges off it and run off and eat them. And
there are some books. I know the American Horticultural Society has a book called Plant Propagation, the Fully Illustrated Plant-by-Plant Manual of Practical Techniques. And there's another textbook that I'm trying to remember on plant propagation. I can't remember the name of the author.
At home, I've got a couple of books on propagating basically anything. So the thing is that obviously you need to asexually propagate it. So doing a seed isn't going to get you the same tree. Usually, a fruit tree is going to be grafted. So that would be the way that you would propagate it, is if you could get your hands on some orange rootstock, and then you could graft onto it. You could take some scions and graft onto it. That's probably the way orange trees are mostly propagated. Yeah. You could also try air layering, which is where you make a slit in the stem and you wrap peat moss around it, and then you try to get the roots growing in there. And that's one way that I know you can propagate them. If you're not having luck with that, there may be things that we would have to look up where it's the time of the year, if it's on 1 year old growth or 2 year old growth.
I've done that too. I've taken like the new growth off it and tried that. I've taken old growth off it. I did try to do what you said with the, you know, on the live plants where you peel a little of the bark back, put some of the rooting hormone on it, I put a plug around it. That's, I think, going to be the most promising, but it's hard because I did it in the middle, right when it started to vegetate and it dried out. So challenge was keeping it moist enough and not too moist where the rooting hormone just kind of washed off, but to keep it so it, I actually get roots. So I think that's my best bet.
And and it's probably going to take a long time for it to grow roots because this trees aren't that fast growing in the first place, and you've got, you said this tree hasn't put on any growth in a while. So,
oh, no, it grows. Well, I keep cutting it back because I keep trying to propagate it.
Oh,
so
okay.
So I'm just bonsaiing it back, trying to get babies off it. So.
Okay.
No.
Okay. You know, it's one of those things where if it's not broken, don't fix it. So we would say just leave it alone. But at the same time, it shocks me that it's not even been fertilized, because what is it living on then? And so normally we would say, okay, it's time to put it into a pot that's a couple inches bigger, not a lot bigger, but just a couple inches bigger, and some fresh soil so that you get some nutrients and aeration and stuff like that, because it's probably nothing but one big ball of roots in that pot after this amount of time.
Must love to be root bound.
Right. And, you know, sometimes those pots just crack and pop open when they get so full of roots like that. But, you know, you've obviously got the right light conditions and stuff, and putting it in and out for the seasons. It seems to be happy with that. But like I said, I've never propagated a citrus tree. So I think, you know, grafting is probably the
best way.
Most common way. Otherwise, we'd have to really do some research on that.
Good luck. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill in Madison, we go to you next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Okay, so I started some long day onions from seed. And I know it's a little late, but they're just coming up right now. And I know that long day onions start to bulb depending on the amount of daylight there is. So I'm trying to figure out, they'll be under lights, how much time under lights do I give them now, and should I just slowly increase that length of time until I get them out into the garden next month or whatever, or you know, because I don't want to do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So long day onions need about 14 to 15 hours of daylight for them to bulb. Okay, so if you keep the days shorter than that, they're not going to bulb, so you might try to keep them shorter than that while they're indoors. So, but they've got to get to a certain age. They've got to get old enough before they're going to want to bulb anyhow. So one, you know, we should be able to get them outside in a few weeks with onions. You know, they can handle a lot of cool and stuff. So as long as your soil dries out, and then they're just going to, follow the natural cycle of things. But in the northern part of the country, long day onions are the ones that we want to grow. So you've got the right ones. The short day ones are grown in the south more. But it's 14 to 15 hours before they're going to bulb. So increasing the day length is what they're naturally doing outside. So if they're not getting any actual daylight and it's all your supplemental lighting, sure, you could increase it slowly, but they've got to get physiologically old enough and then have 14 to 15 hours of daylight before they're going to bulb.
There we go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Naomi, just to close here, says, I can't even think about growing the season now. I've got 24 inches of snow on the ground.
Oh, yeah. It is just disgusting, isn't it? But like I said, it can change fast. And at the same time, we might have a long, long cold spring and a cool summer. And
we're not going to be happy.
We're never happy. We're never happy. But we take what we get.
Diana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Larry.
Diana,
have a great day.
Yeah, you as well. Diana Alfeth is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. Great to have her along. She'll be back. Liz Freemuth coming back, The Garden Hoe, next week on Garden Talk. Monday we'll talk advanced directives for healthcare. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.